On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
I might just bring in my guests who are going to go through this morning's newspapers. We're joined by John O'Brien, who's a professor of European politics at NUI Maynooth, and also by Ilona Duffy, who's a GP and the head of the North East Doctor on Call Service. Good morning to you both. John, I'll start with yourself. Is there anything about the coverage of the situation in Northern Ireland which jumps out at you from this morning's papers?
Good morning, Gavin. I think Brian is absolutely right that this is multi-layered and multi-tiered. There are two pieces in this morning's newspapers that particularly capture this. Dervla MacDonald in the Sunday Independent and Deirdre Heenan in the Business Post. And they both argue that unionism has been on the defensive for some time, and that indeed Deirdre Heenan argues that loyalism is now in a kind of tailspin, and that in many senses Brexit has been used as cover, and that actually if you look back to the 22 years since the Good Friday Agreement was signed, 23 in fact, there really hasn't been a peace dividend for many of these communities, both loyalist and Republican. I mean, anybody who goes to the Shankill Road and the Falls Road, you know, within a short period of time, you can see the commonalities, which is poverty and deprivation, educational underachievement. Yeah. And those are the kind of layers, I think, that can be woven into the kind of macro issues that Brian has pointed to. They're very real and they exist. Most people who Dervla describes as the ceasefire babies will have very little sense of what Brexit actually means. But it is, in a sense, a kind of battering ram that's being used by some to cover up for their own serial failures on Brexit. And, that doesn't underscore, I think, the seriousness of this and how it might actually escalate in the months to come with the marching season and so on.
Sure. We're just getting Brian back in a more stable line. So in the meantime, Ilona, is there anything for you that jumps out from the coverage of this morning's papers?
Well, I suppose, just in one of the papers here in the Business Post on page 2, just an article by Aidan Corkery, and just saying that PUP leader Billy Hutchinson claims the rioters aren't acting on behalf of the paramilitary groups, and really saying that they've no role in stopping them, that it's up to the police. And I suppose, as already has been stated, the pictures that we're seeing of the people who are involved with these are young. They're people who weren't part of previous troubles, who've grown up in a time that was meant to be of a time of peace. But really what we're seeing here is that underneath it all, I think the uncertainty of what's happening to them as they move forward in the north and their future, whether they'll be part of Europe, whether they'll be part of UK and a separate UK. And also, I suppose, the deep divisions that are still there, that while we kind of have thought that, you know, as time was going to go by and as new generations would come, we'd see more integration, less segregation. We're still seeing those strong divisions.
John, you pointed out the piece by Deirdre Heenan in today's Business Post. It's quite a striking headline, because often we can say, well, you know, the fault of all of this, the trigger, is not the protocol, it's Brexit. But Deirdre Heenan's piece generally takes the attitude that it's not really Brexit that has betrayed loyalists, it's the DUP.
Exactly. Within the article, Deirdre argues that when push comes to shove, the DUP reverts to its default position of provoking and exploiting the kind of insecurities that Brian was talking about there within the unionist community. It's zero sum on almost everything. Unionists are always painted as losers and victims of the peace process, and nationalists as winners. So whether it's the advance of the GAA in Northern Ireland, the potential enactment of the Irish Language Act, the position of migrants within the society, it's always defensive and reactive. And for me, Gavin, the big question, I think, in the years to come is about whether unionists are capable, the unionist leadership, whether in the DUP or the other formations, whether they're capable of thinking strategically about Northern Ireland, if it is to remain within the union over the next 10 years and 20 years, what have they got to offer? And the evidence, I think, thus far is pretty damning. And remember that a year from now, we will have elections to the Northern Ireland Assembly. Mm. What does the unionist leadership do if, for example, Sinn Féin becomes the largest party in the Assembly, if Michelle O'Neill prospectively becomes first minister?
Which the current polls do suggest is quite a likely prospect.
And we have the vote on the protocol for the first time in 2024. When the agreement was made between Leo Varadkar and Boris Johnson, I always thought that subsequent to that, this could be a real flashpoint. Will unionists, for example, turn up to the Assembly and vote if they believe that that decision is going to be to uphold the protocol. And if they don't participate in the vote, what do they do? Do they bring people out onto the streets? Is that the only way they have of going forward?
Yeah, do you go back to the point that Brian made, that if basically unionists don't participate in that vote, then is there any future for the Stormont institutions? And if they collapse again, then do they have any kind of long-term future at all? Ilona, just on the point of the New Ireland and some of the practical things that Brian just mentioned there, I'm very conscious that you're in a frontier border county and you're practicing in the healthcare sector, and one of the practical things that people always point to as a reason against unity is that the North wouldn't really ever want to give up the health service that they have. How would you see the whole process of trying to match up the systems on both sides of a border possibly going?
Well, I think we could learn from what's good about both systems, and there are good things in both systems. Obviously, in the North, they're part of the NHS, which has that free access at all levels of healthcare to everybody. So that includes general practice. Here in the South, we have access to free healthcare in the hospital settings, but some of the community supports, such as public health nurses and GP access, isn't free, so patients pay for it. But again, the only thing to benefit that is means that we have better access to our general practice services in the South, although that has become strained in the last few years, whereas in the North, it's very difficult to be seen. There are waiting lists of weeks to be seen by your GP in the UK system. So I think there are things to learn, but there are parts that, I suppose, during all of this COVID time, that if we'd had better kind of, I suppose, better leadership in the North and linking in with us here with regards to health things. So I suppose the public health is the biggest thing. And Professor Gabriel Scally has talked about this from the beginning of the COVID, that the lack of joined up thinking has really impacted on numbers, and for a long time impacted on numbers in border counties on the southern side of the border, because obviously the rates were so high in the North, and that was definitely seeping into the South. I suppose now we're going to benefit. Rates in the border counties are low, and especially Monaghan, which was the highest for almost 2 months after Christmas, is amongst the lowest, and that definitely, I feel, has been helped by the fact that the vaccination rates are so high in the North and their rates of COVID have plummeted so low. So I think, you know, what we've got to do is we've got to add up the good things and learn from them and use both if we are to have a joined up system.
One friend of mine who lives in Belfast pointed out before that, yes, although you can get your doctor's appointment for free on the NHS, it's only free if your time is worth nothing, and that often the waiting list to get that GP's appointment can be so long that maybe it doesn't feel quite as valuable as those of us in the South might perceive. We're still joined on the line by John O'Brien, who's a professor in European politics at Maynooth University, and by Ilona Duffy, who's a GP based in Monaghan, and she's the medical director of the North East Doctor on Call Service. And Ilona, I'll come to you first, because I'm just prompted by a piece on page 5 today of the Sunday Independent about how only half of the expected AstraZeneca doses are going to arrive this week, and that there will already be listeners rolling their eyes going, sure, what else is new with AstraZeneca and delayed vaccine arrivals? But it prompts me to ask how your vaccine rollout in your clinic is going, because the last time I spoke to you, I think it was just on the cusp of rolling out to cohort 3, which was the over 85s, and you were saying that it was already going to be a fairly slow process. How have you found it since?
It's been slow. We kind of felt that there was a bit of a delay in us getting the vaccines, and we knew because of the logistics of transporting the vaccines. Initially, all GPs were to be vaccinating all their patients who were over 70 with AstraZeneca, and there would have been less problems with the transport of that. But then issues arose and a decision was made that we would use the mRNA vaccines, meaning Pfizer and Moderna. And these, as people may remember, have to be frozen for, and they were stable at frozen and have a limited time when they're unfrozen. And like the likes of Pfizer has to be used within days, the Moderna can have 30 days after it's taken out of the freezer. So delivering those to GP practices obviously became a mammoth task, given that they had to be delivered to multiple practices all over the country. And rather than kind of deciding and targeting one area, it was a kind of a scattergun approach. But that meant that you could be in a town, as we were here in Monaghan, where there was a difference of 5 weeks between the first practice in town getting vaccines and the last practice in town getting them.
Were you one of the other of those? We were middle.
Thank God we were in the middle. But we still got a lot of hassle about that, let me tell you, because we were getting phone calls saying, well, my neighbour's got my vaccine, or my dad's got his vaccine, why? And my mum's a patient of yours. What are you doing wrong? Why haven't you got the vaccines? Now, thankfully for us, we're well underway. We will have a clinic this coming Saturday for the last group of first doses. That'll be all the remainder of our over 70s will be vaccinated this Saturday. But again, it'll be then 4 weeks before they'll get their second dose, which means it's going to be middle of May before we're finished all our over 70s. And the following week, we'll be doing another 440. So I can tell you, it's a lot of work, because ringing all of those people, arranging them, and obviously having to, we're now limited to doing it at weekends because our numbers are so big as we move down through the groups that it would interrupt our daytime services too much. So our staff are kind of getting a little cheesed off, but we've kind of guaranteed them this is it. We as a practice have made the decision that we won't be involved in any further vaccinations for COVID of the at-risk groups. We'd be leaving that to the community hubs and to the hospital setting, because we just can't continue if we're going to be having to cancel normal daytime routine service. It's just impossible.
So when it then comes to what, finishing cohort four, did you even start on cohort four with the underlying conditions? But after you've done with that, then you're out. You just can't deal with the workload anymore.
What we do is some of the at-risk, if we have vaccines left over from the doses that we're getting for next Saturday, but we won't be formally moving on with that. And again, the difficulty with that is that already announcements have been made. You'll be getting your vaccine through your GP. But this is something that I'm not the only practice. There are many practices who have said, if we're to do that, we're going to have to be closing our practices for a half day or a full day a week to normal routine work. And we're busier than ever. And we already realise that people are struggling to kind of get the healthcare that they want, because hospitals still haven't fully reopened their clinics or their tests or their investigations. And we're seeing increased kind of demands as a result of that. We're at the front line for people, and they kind of ring up saying getting worse. So we need to be available.
So when Paul Reid then says that although it's going to be the mass vaccination centres that are going to carry the bulk of this, when he talks about that he's being absolutely assured that there'll be enough people because it's not only the new recruits, but also existing GPs and pharmacists and the like, is there a doubt in your mind as to whether there will in fact be enough staff, because there could be other clinics like your own who just decide that this is too much work?
I think there will, but also we totally are aware that they haven't enough vaccinators for the planned rollout of the mass vaccine clinics. And that's probably one of the delays in opening them up fully. And partly that is, OK, absolutely, we can't open them until we know we have the vaccines coming in. But at this stage, although we're seeing the problems with, you know, AstraZeneca, as you've stated there, that article today saying this week there'll be 14,000 fewer AstraZeneca vaccines coming in, we should be seeing the rise in the number of Pfizer, Moderna, and hopefully we'll start seeing Johnson & Johnson coming too. So we have more, like we've ordered way more than we think we're going to need to be prepared for this kind of scenario where we may fail in the deliveries of another one. But our next problem is, are we going to be able to have enough staff to vaccinate in the clinics? Now, there have been massive barriers in getting volunteers and getting people to come and work. Initially, you have to kind of guarantee that you'd work full time in them. So that was pointless if you're a GP in a practice. So we would have volunteered to work in COVID hubs and maybe on our day off or weekends, dumb days. And our staff and ourselves and GPs around the country and GP practice nurses and dentists would be willing to do similar kind of thing. But they obviously can't do full weeks. But then you also come to the whole process to become a vaccinator.
Were you asked for your junior cert results somewhere along the line?
We didn't even try yet because we're hoping they'll have it sorted out. But yes, you could ask for your junior cert results. And then there is also an article in the paper where Aidan McGoldrick, a GP, is talking about wanting to volunteer as well and being expected to go to Dublin for a full half day to do a half day in-site training, despite us all having done a 3.5-hour online course on it, despite the fact that all of us are doing vaccinations and injections every single day of our working days. So we've got to look at that, and they've got to streamline the process and be practical.
I do want to get to John before I have to take another break, but very quickly, Ilona, if there were to be a change in approach where the GPs were asked to take the lead and it might only be, for example, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, one shot, room temperature, done and dusted, far less laborious to try and administer, would there be any hope for clinics like your own getting back on board, or has the ship sailed for you?
No, I think if we're kind of, we've assisted and helped with this, and I think that's all we want. We want some help. Now, we've done a fantastic job in general practice and administered almost half the vaccines that have been delivered in the country because we've worked so well. But that has been to the cost of our daytime services. And it's also been huge demand on us, and not only us, but mainly actually on our staff who've prepared these clinics. So I think, yes, if it was a single dose, that would have the amount of work for us. But it's still a big ask. And I think we will absolutely manage up to this if it's going to help, and it's going to help people get vaccinated in a fast and efficient manner.
Let me go back to John O'Brien, Professor of European Politics at Maynooth University. John, there's a few things written today about the EU's vaccine strategy and about the politics of maybe a digital green cert. With your wider perspective on the EU, you know, this has been identified as the ultimate test for the EU and for the European project. Do you foresee there being enough cohesion and enough leadership in Brussels to try and really develop a common European approach to get us out of all the restrictions that we're in and to bring back the travel that we're used to?
Well, firstly, Gavin, let's remember that most of the responsibility and legal competence here lies with member states at the national level and not with the EU. Mm. The EU role has really been limited to coordination. But for all the missteps and the sometimes hysterical coverage by some quarters of the media in the UK, in particular in recent weeks, the EU has really got its act together in the recent past. And just as was envisaged before Christmas, we're now seeing a real ramping up of vaccine distribution. France, for example, reached a level of 500,000 vaccines the other day. Germany went beyond 700,000. That's equivalent to about 2.5 million per day in the United States.
We did 27,000 on Friday, new figures this morning.
That's right. And I expect that, you know, that will increase significantly in the weeks ahead. So, you know, I think the situation will have changed very significantly by mid-June. And I do expect that we're going to see some kind of form of EU vaccine certificate introduced that will be coordinated, yeah. I think.
Is there a danger, though, on that, though, John, that you kind of develop this two-tier society where those who have been offered vaccines, those who are, you know, older or have underlying conditions, will then be enjoying freedoms that those of us at the bottom of the queue, those who are younger or able-bodied, simply just won't be able to anticipate for a few months yet?
Yes, that's absolutely the case, I think. But we have to remember, Gavin, that for all of the good things that are happening with the vaccine rollout globally, we've also seen a very significant level of infection persisting. Many parts of the world. India has had 150,000 infections a day over the last week or so. Brazil has had a disastrous time, 4,000 people a day dying. In Chile, and Chile is a really interesting case because it's perceived as a vaccine success. Almost 40% of the population has been vaccinated. And yet they've had to go back into lockdown with 7,000 plus infections this week, precisely because of the complacency that had crept in as a result of the success of the vaccine, ironically, and because the vaccine that they're using, Sinovac, is less effective than the Pfizer vaccine, for example. So we'll have all of these variables in play in Europe. And let's remember that the P1 variant in Brazil is really what's behind the havoc that's happened in Brazil. We're seeing that appear in Europe as well. So we're going to be grappling with those kind of issues for many, many months and perhaps a couple of years to come. Mm. And the vaccine certificate, I think, is just one part of the solution to this. And the EU will play an important role in getting that out.
Sure. Well, it is the presence of the Brazilian variant which has caused some European countries to be added to the list for mandatory hotel quarantine. We'll be talking about some of the inconsistencies about that with Eamon Ryan later in the programme. Ilona Duffy and John O'Brien still with me going through this morning's newspapers. And John, I wanted to come to you about the whole question of mandatory hotel quarantine and where exactly freedom of movement fits into all of this, because we know that some concern around the rights of EU citizens and freedom of movement around the bloc is part of what has been the government stumbling for the last couple of days. News today via the Business Post that the European Commission has told us it's fine to add quarantine, at least to Austria.
That's right, Gavin. Aidan Corkery's piece in the Business Post quotes an official from the European Commission as pointing out that as long as the arrangements put in place are proportionate, then they are absolutely fine. I would go back to the beginning of the COVID crisis a year ago and just point out that at that time, the European Union suspended state aid rules, for example, which are usually very, very rigid. And they did so on request by the member states who were trying desperately to keep airlines afloat and things like that. So it allowed for this flexibility or wiggle room that would not normally be there. Freedom of movement is not absolute. And within the piece of Aidan Corkery, Gabriel Scali is quoted, and he says, "I'm unaware of freedom of travel being interpreted to mean that you can bring disease anywhere you live in the European Union." He's absolutely right. There is nothing absolute about this, and I can't see any reason why we can't make this work.
So have the concerns then that have been apparently been raised within cabinet level for the last 2 weeks, do they hold any water for you? Because one thing that struck me was that it would be nonsense if there was supposed to be some exemption for EU citizens to this mandatory hotel quarantine if in fact Irish citizens were still obligated to undergo it.
Yes, but I mean, remember when Simon Coveney first made this point, he was talking about 20,000 or so Irish people in France who might need to get home and wouldn't be able to do so. Well, they would be able to. They would just have to do this quarantine. But his point, I think, just reveals how absurd this is. Are Irish people less likely to be carrying the P1 variant, for example, or other variants, you know, than other people? Are we genetically predisposed in that way? Of course we're not. So you cannot. The only way you can discriminate against people, I think, is on the basis that they potentially have the virus or they don't. And we saw in the case of those people who have quarantined in hotels, for example, at least 10 of them have tested positive. So there's a very, very good case for doing it. We should have done it a year ago. Where we did it, it was half-hearted and it didn't really work. I know that in other European jurisdictions where home quarantine was used, for example, the police would call daily, once or twice a day. Mm. And if you weren't there, you were subject to large fines. We could have done that quite easily last June and we didn't. And now we're in this position where we're attempting to do this in a very uncertain climate. Okay. And of course, there is clearly a division within the cabinet between the Ministry of Health on the one hand and Foreign Affairs on the other, and probably between the political parties. That accounts for the kind of tension that we've seen in recent days. Mm. I just don't think there's any alternative to doing
it. Well, it's kind of interesting then that the Green Party's Minister for Transport, Eamon Ryan, might be the sort of the Switzerland in the middle of all of this, trying to keep the peace. Yes. And we'll have him with us in just a few minutes' time. But again, can I pick your legal brain then just for a moment, just before I go back to Alona? Should there be any difference, or do you think legally there is any difference between asking people to undergo quarantine if they're coming from a country that has a new variant, or if they're merely coming from a country that happens to have a high level of COVID to begin with?
No, I think the case for quarantine, I think, should be obviously made on a rolling basis, because infection numbers go up and down. And we did see these red and green lists evolve, being used by different countries in different ways, going back to last spring and summer. So I think the only basis, you know, for looking at people and making decisions should be on whether they're coming from a country with a very high level of infection or a country that has a relatively low level. That's the only way, I think, proportionately, you can actually make this work.
Yeah, I suppose you've just reminded me that it was only last summer when the European Commission and Council were behind this whole traffic light system. And even at that point, then there was an implicit European approval for stopping or impeding or requiring some sort of, some sort of quarantine if someone was coming from a red country. So evidently, there's already some EU backing for the principle of having some inhibitions on travel, just given the circumstances that we're in.
Yeah. Last summer, actually, at the end of June, I was traveling. I was working on COVID in Eastern Europe, and I was traveling to Bulgaria, and I flew from Dublin, but I had to connect from Luton because it was the only way I could get there. Mm. And when I landed, I literally sailed through. I mean, there was a whole team of people suited up, greeting everybody, came off the plane. But I got through because I was on a green list country. The UK was a red list country at that time. So all the poor Bulgarian people who followed me all had to go into quarantine for a couple of weeks in that system that I've just described. And if they transgressed at all, they would have been subject to fines. So there were differences then. I think those differences will continue to exist in the months to come.
Were it ever thus, I suppose. Alona Duffy, just to finish with you, because we've got about 90 seconds left. There's quite a bit written in today's papers around the whole concept of restrictions easing tomorrow and whether that might create an expectation for what's coming forward. Very briefly, is there anything on that topic that jumps out for you in the papers?
Well, I suppose, go back briefly to the previous thing. The countries we have to look to have worked best at containing this virus and keeping it under control have been Australia and New Zealand, who've had stringent mandatory quarantining for months and months and months, and it works. We've got to get it working, but we've got to ensure it works. And also, those who are coming into the country still have to, you know, have been tested in advance and test when they come in. So even from the, let's say, the non-high risk countries, the level two countries, we're not seeing any follow-up of them. So if we want to contain this, we have to work hard. And I think people have to realise that the majority of the country have been adhering to a 5 kilometre restriction. They've had their personal freedom restricted, but have taken that because they understand the importance of it. And to see people challenging mandatory quarantine when they've made a decision to come from a country when they've known they would require it, just beggars belief. So I think we are opening up. We've got to be careful. I think the worry is that once we open up a bit, people see kind of the light and see the freedom and think that it's more than it is. And I think people still have to be cautious cautious, not meet in large groups, not have the parties, not have the gatherings. There's still no indoor meeting for people unless you've been both vaccinated. And I think it's people remembering that. But the big message is, let's see the vaccine rollout. Let's see people be vaccinated safe, and then we can really start opening up things.
Okay, great stuff. We will leave it there. Thank you very much, both of you, for your time this morning. Really some very valuable insights on everything in the papers. John O'Brien, Professor of European Politics at Maynooth University, and Ilona Duffy, who's a GP in Monaghan and the head of the North East Doctor on Call Service.